uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, my friends, lovers of democracy, peace, and justice, believers in truth, freedom, and the American way. How are you? Scramble up those words. Welcome to our program. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live on radio stations from coast to coast, on Sirius Satellite Radio, on WhiteRoseSociety.org, RadioPower.org, Live365's American FM, and in cable systems in 29 states, on CRN Digital. Welcome to our program. U.S. dependence on foreign crude will keep growing. Notes Reuters News Service, article by Robert Gibbons, will keep growing despite efforts to spur domestic production as demand in the world's largest energy consumer, that would be us, outpaces supply, industry and government experts predicted on Tuesday. Now, there's an interesting kind of, what would you call that, click to that. In fact, I thought I had it right here. Here it is. Pardon my fumbling. The Wall Street Journal, it was either yesterday's or this morning's. I'm not sure. I read both of them this morning. So, and I clipped it out. I don't have the date on the top. But in any case, the Wall Street Journal had this article titled, Oil Industry's Refining Squeeze Limits Prospects of Price Relief. And in theory, the article is an overview of how we don't have refining capacity and therefore the price of gasoline is going up. But the graph that they have is very, very interesting. It's called the operating profit margin for refining a barrel of crude oil. And in dollars, how much profit do you make from converting a barrel of crude oil into gasoline? And in 2000, the profit was just a little over a dollar, about a dollar and a quarter. In 2001, it was a little over a dollar, about a dollar and a quarter. 2002, it actually dropped. It was a little less than a dollar. And then Bushonomics took effect. In 2003, it went up to over $2 a barrel. In 2004, it went to over $3 a barrel. And in 2005, they're estimating in the neighborhood of $4 a barrel. Profit. So is it that we're running low on oil? Well, certainly we are facing the prospect of running low on oil. We're facing, you know, international competition for oil. And certainly the price of crude oil is going up as a function of that, as a direct function of the fact that the world is producing, depending on whose numbers you look at, the world is capable of producing about 80 million barrels a day, and we're consuming about 78, okay? So, you know, that's the projected possibility. But the reality seems to be that what's actually happening is that the oil companies are using this as an excuse to price gouge. That they're just, you know, they're saying, hey, you know, we can charge more. We'll just blame it on the Arabs. We'll blame it on the Middle East. We'll let George Bush take the heat for it. Actually, they'll figure out a way to blame it on Clinton. You know how that works. So here, Reuters reports, it's a really interesting juxtaposition, both of them in the news in the last 24 hours. Reuters reports, U.S. dependence on foreign crude will keep growing. The rising need for oil shipments to the nation's ports could hit a level soon that foreign crude producers might have a hard time matching, translating into likely declines in the nation's stockpiles. They add the prognosis for increased foreign dependence comes as U.S. lawmakers struggle to hammer out an energy bill. President Bush's administration hopes to open up two drilling parts of the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge and provide tax incentives to spur exploration. Rick Mueller, however, the oil manager at Boston-based Energy Securities Analysts, say the oil in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, which they've unsuccessfully now twice tried to rename as the Arctic National Oil Reserve, the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. The oil there, says Rick Mueller, constitutes, and I quote, a drop in the bucket. He goes on to say, the volumes they're talking about by the time they start to come online in 2011 or 2012 will probably not match up with growth in U.S. demand alone, and that doesn't take into account continued decline of other U.S. oil fields. In other words, you know, ain't going to do any good. But then you go back to the Wall Street Journal, and they say two interesting little pieces that you find buried in this front page story. The first, that the profit on refining a barrel of oil. Forget about the price of the oil itself. The profit on refining a barrel of oil has gone from about 75 cents in 2002 to about $4 right now. Which might account for why the oil companies are absolutely awash in cash. They have more money than they know what to do with. They are just awash in cash. Number one. And number two, the Wall Street Journal also notes, for those of you who are wondering, you know, where should you invest your money? Not that I would recommend investing in oil, but it's like Will Rogers about land. You know, he said his daddy told him, son, buy real estate. They ain't making no more of it. And history proves that it was good advice. You could say the same about oil. And the Wall Street Journal notes, many industry analysts are forecasting a second peak in crude oil prices later this year to more than $60 for a barrel of U.S. benchmark crude. Now, again, I think it's so important to point out to people that oil going to $60 a barrel means it's going to be more expensive in the United States, but it may well not mean that it's going to be more expensive in, for example, Europe. Why? Well, because oil is denominated in dollars. It's priced in dollars all around the world, and the value of the dollar has been dropping ever since Bush came into office. Ever since he revived Reaganomics in a big way and brought us, you know, Bushonomics, voodoo economics, cut the taxes on the millionaires and billionaires, jack up the taxes on the average working person and call it a Social Security tax increase, as Ravi Batra pointed out to us the other day. Greenspan's fraud. As long as you can get away with that, he says, you know, go for it. This is what the Bushies are doing. And the result, of course, is that the world looks at us and goes, these guys are bankrupt. I mean, they're looking at the American economy. They're looking at and they're saying, there's nothing there. There's no there. The United States, $666 billion trade deficit last year. Which I'm surprised it didn't send the fundamentalists screaming into the streets. 666 out of the Bush administration? Of course, now there's been a rereading of the ancient texts, the ancient scrolls from which they, you know, the oldest sources for the Book of Revelation. And they're saying that it looks like maybe the number was actually 616. 616. So yeah, now they're having to recalculate everything. But I digress. So, you know, I just wanted to make that point. I found that very interesting before I move on to other things. It's just, you know, keep in mind what's really going on here. And, of course, the big what's really going on, of course, is that we're running out of oil. At the same time, it's like the rich getting richer, the poor getting poorer. We're running low on oil. And I'm convinced that one of the reasons why we're seeing, and here's my conspiracy theory for the day, okay? I'll lay this out. And I'm not saying I'm absolutely right on this. I may be wrong. I don't know. But this is my guess, okay? So this isn't even an assertion. This is a theory, a guess. That the reason why in the United States for the last, few hundred years you had, well, the last 200 years, other than the robber baron era, when we were running out of wood, we were actually starting to run low on wood. It's really interesting. Living up in Vermont, as I did for years and years, the entire state had been deforested by 1890. I mean, there were, for all practical purposes, no trees left in Vermont. You see old pictures of it from that time. There's all kinds of trees now. You walk around the forests, and you won't find a tree that's got a diameter of more than about a foot and a half. 100-year-old tree, 150-year-old tree. That's it. And the reason why was because everybody was heating with wood. Well, coal came up into the Northeast in the 1880s, 1890s, and allowed that transition. But they were running out of wood. So, you know, there was an energy crisis happening. And it corresponded with a period of the rich getting incredibly rich and the average working people getting poorer, wiping out of the middle class.
during the robber baron era, lasted right up until the 1930s. And then the middle class started emerging in the late 1930s, early 1940s, and was relatively solid until Reagan came along in 1980 and declared war on working people. And now we have another energy shortfall, the oil shortage, and again the rich are getting incredibly rich and the middle class is being wiped out again. Could it be that the folks who are wiping out the middle class are doing so because they're concerned that resources are going to run scarce, and they need to build their mansions, their palaces, their gated communities, their 10,000-acre spreads in Montana, so that they don't have to worry about the rabble if difficult times come? Could it be? I don't know. It would make a good plot for a novel. That's what it would make. It would make a good storyline for a novel. A bunch of folks sitting around, you know, hatching conspiracies. You know, hey, let's take this country down, they'd say, you get it. I don't need to go on and on about this. Another piece of interesting news today, this is from the Associated Press. Uzbekistan, you will recall, Uzbekistan is one of George Bush's buddies. They are an ally in the war on terror. Now, who is terror? I mean, we had a war on Germany once, we had a war on Japan once, we had a war on England once, we had a war on the Spanish once, we had a war in Grenada, even. But don't recall a country named terrorism. We've had wars on other rhetorical devices. We had a war on illiteracy. We had a war on drugs. We had a war on poverty. But anyhow, in the war on terrorism, Bush says that Uzbekistan is an ally because they've been letting us use a base in Uzbekistan to stage operations in Afghanistan. They're right up there in that area. And then a couple of weeks ago, specifically May 13th, Uzbekistan's leader, their president, Islam Karimov, had a bit of a problem, bit of a political problem. A whole bunch of people, I mean thousands of people, came out into the streets to protest his actions. Now, the story, it's hard to get a straight story out of this thing, but the story is that there were 23 businessmen who he had thrown in jail, and he had claimed that they were Islamic extremists, and they were claiming that they were, you know, democracy advocates. They wanted a free market, and he was doing what Putin was doing, you know, trying to stop the oligarchs, and other people say they were, well, who knows? Anyhow, a crowd came, broke him out of jail, and he opens fire on the crowd, kills a couple hundred people. Well, he's up to some new tricks. I'll tell you about him right after this. 20 minutes past the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back. 25 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. This is all about oil and foreign policy. This is what this boils down to. Energy policy, foreign policy. Karimov, Islam Karimov, the president of Uzbekistan, today is on his way to China. He's on his way to China. Beijing is saying it's just fine what he did, slaughtering his citizens. Now, NATO and the European Union have called for an independent investigation of the events, but Karimov has said, no, we're not going to do that. China said, this from Kong Quan, the Chinese foreign ministry spokesman, China supports the efforts by the Uzbekistan government to stabilize their domestic situation and their commitment to development of the country, end quote. Now, what does he mean by development? Can you spell oil and natural gas and pipelines? Yeah. And when they talk about stabilize, well, that's what the Chinese value, stability. That's why there's only one labor union in all of China, the government union. That's why Walmart loves to make things over there. And not just Walmart. So much of American industry loves to make things over there because it's stable. You don't have to worry about people doing those kind of unruly, messy things like protesting or asking for democracy because they just put them in jail or kill them. What have we become supporting these kinds of people? And not just supporting them. I mean, we are in a situation now where we are dependent upon them. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number, TomHartman.com, the website. If you want to drop into the live chat room, just click live chat, and it will get you there. John in the Scranton area of Pennsylvania on the line. Hey, John, what's up?
Tom, how are you? How are you?
Great. What's up,
yeah.
John?
Well, this whole thing, oil and foreign policy, is the one thing that I watch the news for every single day. All you have to do is do Bush oil in the country of your choice, where there's a populist uprising, and you pretty much come to these same stories over and over again. And I feel for these people, and I think it's wrong. Here's my question, though. Aside from the fact that this, you know, oil imperialism is wrong, supporting dictators so we can extort the country, World Bank, combinations, all these horrible things that happen all the time, confessions of an economic hitman, what would be the reality if, in your opinion, if all these countries, populist movements in Ecuador, in Bolivia, in Venezuela, all over the world, were benefiting 100% from the oil and life was basically different, that there weren't dictators in all of these oil-rich countries. These were wealthy, populous, democratic countries. What would that do to us? Like, I guess that, like, you know, they say, careful what you wish for.
Yeah, well, that's the problem. You would have countries that would be functionally like Norway.
Yeah.
I mean, Norway's wealth right now, Norway has always been, I won't say a relatively poor country, but they've never been a really rich country. They haven't had, you know, the banking business of Switzerland. They haven't had the huge landmass of France. They've got a lot of fjords and a lot of snow, and maybe an occasional parrot pining for the fjords, but no parrots though. Bad joke. Sorry, Monty Python joke. But in any case, when they discovered oil, they said, hey, this oil belongs to the Norwegian people. You know, Norway has built a marvelous quality of life for itself on their oil. And mm-hmm. That's what you would have. You would have Norway in those countries. Now, Norway is not helping us out tremendously. And so maybe we'll bomb them.
What would that do to all the recipient countries of oil, like the United States and Europe, that don't have huge oil reserves?
Well, that's the thing.
Because now you're needing more oil consumption because these countries' standards of living, like China. In one sense, it would be good for the people in the short run, but in the long run, what you're having is the oil's going to get used up even faster, and it may cost us more. I'm not saying that that is, well, in that case, it's okay to do what we're doing, but...
Well, that's the insanity of our policies.
Long time.
Yeah, the absolute insanity of our policy is that our policy is to consume all the oil we have, and it's very profitable for the oil companies and for the Bushies, but it's wiping us out and the rest of the world. What Europe, like Germany has no oil at all. What do they do? $5 a gallon, right? It's a, you know, $4 a gallon tax, plus they encourage biodiesel. John, thanks for the call. Good to hear from you. I appreciate it. Tom Hartman with you, 29 minutes past the hour.
Democracy to the United States of America. Here's Tom Hartman.
I'm not feeling too good myself. But we'll get better. Welcome back, my friends. Yeah, the United States of America, we're doing all right. We're doing all right. It's it's kind of like we got a cold, you know. We got a bush. But it'll go away, you know. Eventually we'll recover our sanity and wake back up. See, this is interesting. Frist's bait and switch on the judiciary. I want to share this with you from the Center for American Progress. Shortly after the announcement of a compromise on judicial nominations, Senate Majority Leader Bill Frist, the multimillionaire physician from Tennessee, whose father is one of the richest men in America as a result of what some would call good business practices, others would call fraud against the American people by ripping us off medically. It's anyway, it's taking, let me just clarify, taking private hospitals, not private, taking public hospitals, hospitals owned by towns and counties and communities, and privatizing them and then squeezing all the blood out of them. You can call it whatever you want. Anyhow, Bill Frist has indicated he would respect the agreement that these the Gang of 14 came up with. He's on the floor of the Senate. He said, "We all have a role to play in ensuring its cherished nature remains intact. And indeed, as demonstrated by tonight's agreement and by the ultimate implementation of that agreement, we've done just that." However, in public, he urged quick votes on the three nominees that they urged not to filibuster. However, privately, he was pursuing a much different strategy. As part of the compromise, negotiators agreed that two judicial nominees, Myers and Sod, will be filibustered or withdrawn. That was the agreement. That was the compromise. Nevertheless, according to a report in Congress Daily PM, Frist will file for cloture on President Bush's nomination of William Myers to the 9th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals later this week. Right? In other words, he's going to call these guys his bluff. He's going to take, you know, they said, okay, we'll let through three and we're not going to push on two. That was the compromise. And Frist says, oh yeah, you think so? One of those two you're not going to push on? I'm going to push on. And we'll just see how strong your little bunch is. As Frist tries to destroy the deal, others are attempting to write it. Yesterday, Senator Lindsey Graham, Republican of South Carolina, one of the leaders, by the way, of the impeach Clinton crowd, one of the signatories of the compromise, said, and I quote, "If there's a filibuster for a Supreme Court nominee in the future where one of the Senate Democrats who signed the letter participates in the filibuster, all bets are off." Say what? The Hill reports that Senator Mike DeWine, Republican of Ohio, joined Graham in, quote, "threatening to vote for the nuclear option should Democrats attempt to block nominees in circumstances that the two lawmakers would not consider extraordinary," end quote. That's not what they agreed to. Graham and DeWine, you look at the text in their agreement, they agreed not to vote for the nuclear option during the entire 109th Congress, period, in light of the spirit and continuing commitments made in this agreement. The senators have committed to filibuster Supreme Court nominee only in extreme circumstances, not as defined by Lindsey Graham and Mike DeWine, but as defined by their own discretion and judgment. So it looks like the Republicans may be, well, we'll see. We'll see. Graham tries to rewrite the deal, part two. Senator Graham is starting to distort the terms of the deal on Monday night. Appearing on Hardball, he said the deal is that five nominees who've been filibustered will get an up or down vote. Some will be confirmed and some won't. Actually, the deal only provided that three of those nominees would get a vote. But who's counting, right? Notes the Center for American Progress. The future, and this is an interesting take, AmericanProgress.com. The future of the agreement lies not in Congress, but in the White House. The deal encourages the president to consult with members of the Senate, both Democratic and Republican, prior to submitting a judicial nomination to the Senate for consideration. This is what I was talking about yesterday, and on Monday, actually, where I said that basically, historically, the reason why you haven't seen filibusters of circuit court judicial nominees in the past, appeals court nominees in the past, the reason you haven't seen the filibusters is because no party, no president has ever tried to push them all the way onto the floor of the Senate where they would be filibustered. Instead, they consult. You're supposed to, they ask the advice of the Senate. You're supposed to ask for advice and consent. They would ask the advice, that is to say, they would say, hey, do we have enough votes to get this guy out or this woman, you know, voted in? And if the answer was no, you don't have enough votes, then they say, okay, we'll try somebody else. And you had Bill Clinton, I mean, proposing centrist judges, getting 98 votes out of 100. Not the way the cons want to do it. The cons have a little different strategy. And so we'll see how this works out. A senior administration spokesman told the Post, the Washington Post, that Bush is not going to shy away from a fight. The story didn't mention if Bush still considers himself a uniter and not a divider. Yeah, right. Uniter. Amazing. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. Tom in Eureka, California on the line. Hey, Tom, what's up?
Hey, calling you from the most powerful blue state in the union. Greetings this morning. Hey,
thank you.
I just want to tell you about some demonstrators down in India yesterday. Off the Associated Press, it's only the richest there. Santa Cruz is also home to the oil industry there, and the people there want to have a separate autonomy. They kind of want to break away from Bolivia and, I guess, keep all the money. Well, all the poor people took to the streets yesterday in the capital, in La Paz. They were blocking all the streets and demanding that the oil companies be nationalized.
Wow, how did I miss that?
I don't know, and I give it to you, but I'm off today, and I don't have a fax where I'm at.
Okay.
I'm out in the woods. You can hear a chicken in the background, actually.
Cool. That's so in Bolivia, they're protesting oil.
Yeah, they are. They're protesting. They want the profits to be done like what I guess what they're doing over in Venezuela.
Yeah.
You know, they want to get a piece of the action, and with the profits out there right now, who wouldn't?
But, see, the Bush administration has been trying to bring down the government in Venezuela, and, you know, he actually funded a coup attempt and was the only government in the entire world to recognize the folks who executed the coup, and, you know, for the few days there, the Hugo Chavez got thrown out of office, and he got back in, but Bush was saying, oh, yes, we recognize these new, and, you know, because they're nationalizing the profits. They're using the profits to pay for schools. They're using the profits to pay for social welfare programs, social services programs, retirements, pensions, things like that. And the Bush administration considers that socialism and doesn't think that any government should be allowed to do that.
Yeah, well, it's the people's government.
Yeah.
I think it's the people against the WTO, and that's why I think it's such an important story.
Tell that to the Bushies.
On it, or people, you know, just need to look it up.
Yeah, okay, I'll
but that was
out.
Yesterday on the yesterday's AP story, so
okay.
Bolivia protest. Thanks,
okay.
Tom.
Tom, thanks
love
a lot. I appreciate it. Thank
right.
you. Good to hear from you. I appreciate it. 1-866-889-8894, telephone number, Alan in Trumansburg, New York, on the line. Hey, Alan.
Hi, Tom. Have you seen the Bill Moyers address from the National Conference on Media Reform?
Oh, yeah. I read it. In fact, I've shared parts of it on the air here. His rant about public broadcasting being taken over by Tomlinson and the right-wingers.
Right. I think it's terrific. And if any of your listeners missed it, you can get the whole thing from freepress.net.
Freepress.net. Great. And also, I found it. I saw it on commondreams.org. It's also there. It's,
oh,
it's,
okay.
it's all over the web, Alan. But it's a brilliant speech.
Yeah, it's wonderful. There's lots of cool stuff happening. Yesterday, John Conyers hosted a forum called Media Bias and the Future of Freedom of the Press in Washington, and he had Randy and Al and David Brock and a bunch of people on, and you can get clips of that at conyersblog.us.
Great. Okay. Alan, thanks a lot for the information. I appreciate it. Good to hear from you. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. Scott in Richmond, Virginia on the line. Hey, Scott.
Hey, Tom, good afternoon.
Thank you.
I hate to have to be the one to correct you, but it was not a case of bait and switch. It was a case of out-and-out lying.
Okay.
Which, basically, any time a Republican says or tells you anything...
You know they're lying because their lips are moving.
Their lips are moving.
Yeah.
But I think, you know, the perfect retort to that would be the filibuster if it comes to it. And instead of reading hush puppy recipes or whatever gibberish they usually do,
yeah.
they should take the time to list all of the offenses of the Bush administration, starting in 2001. And
that would make one heck of a filibuster, wouldn't it?
Wouldn't it?
But
one that really
you know, I just wonder though. I mean, you had this fellow come over, George, what's his name, come over here from England. You know, the Scotsman Galloway, George Galloway, come over and give this brilliant speech to the United States Senate. Just you know, slap down the Senator Norm Coleman from Minnesota, and not only was it by and large not covered in the mainstream media, but now Coleman has gotten those remarks removed from the Senate record.
Struck from the official record. Isn't it wonderful to be able to create your own history?
I mean, it's amazing. So I'm wondering if the Democrats had a filibuster, if they held a filibuster and really talked about real issues, you know, is it possible that it would be sort of like what if they gave a war and nobody came? Is it likely that it would ever get covered by the mainstream media? I'm doubtful.
Well, if you get the opportunity, you might mention it to Bernie Sanders and ask him to pass it along.
Yeah, it's a good,
you know,
good suggestion.
It's worth a try.
Yeah, although he's in the House, he knows some senators, and that's where the filibuster would happen. Scott, thanks a lot for the call. I appreciate it. Good.
Thank you, Tom.
You're welcome. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number, and I've got a caller here. I don't have a name or number, so I'm not
Frank
sure who it is.
Phoenix, Tom.
Hey, Mike, how you doing?
Oh, no, this is Frank from Phoenix.
Oh, Frank. Hey, Mike. Hey, Frank. Yeah. Sorry about that.
I just want. Oh, that's all right. On this Owens thing, I just wanted to make it clear to all those conservatives. That person did have an up or down vote during the time when Democrats controlled the Congress.
Uh-huh.
She did have an up and down vote then, and she was voted down. I don't recall any other time in the history of Congress where a president brought back a nominee after being rejected off the Senate floor.
So, boy, I didn't realize that.
Yep.
Priscilla, when was she brought before the Senate?
When the Democrats controlled.
This would
Congress.
Be in 2001.
Mm-hmm.
Before the 2002 elections.
Right. She was voted down. Also on this Brownback thing in the stem cell.
Yeah.
He said that he's going to do everything in his power to reject them, reject that, even if it means that he has to keep on talking about it. Sounds like a filibuster to me.
Yeah. Yeah.
And also these Republicans that cry their Christianity all over everybody. Wasn't it Thomas Jefferson that said that about Christianity that it was neither part or ever was anything of the common law?
Yeah, in England. His point was that Sir David Hume had rewritten British history when he said that Christianity was the foundation for British common law. And Jefferson's argument, and it's made in several places in his letters, and it's in my book, What Would Jefferson Do? Jefferson's argument, in fact, he had a correspondence with John Adams about this, and Adams agreed with him. His argument was that from roughly the year 500 to roughly the year 700, England was operating under common law. It was, after the Heptarchy and during the Anglo-Saxon times. And that's the foundation of British law, and that was before the introduction of Christianity to England.
So are they going to start calling Thomas Jefferson a traitor or un-American now?
Well, I think they're already, their respect for the founders goes so far as to use their names in vain, but not to honor their perspectives and things. It's a tragedy. Thanks a lot, Frank. I appreciate it. Good to hear from you. In 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number, Logan in New York City on the line. Hey, Logan.
Hey, what's up, Tom? I was just wondering, do you think that these wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, since they seem to be never-ending, could possibly topple us as a world power?
I think they already have. I don't think that we are seriously taken as a world power any longer. And I think that what is the proof of it is Iran and North Korea. They are both saying, hey, all I've got to do is get a nuclear weapon and the U.S. isn't going to come after me. And history shows that. And they get it. The Bush administration is about being a bully. They're about picking on the small guys. And the Reagan administration is the same thing. You know, Grenada, Panama. I mean, come on. And there is no sense around the world that America is a moral leader any longer. And you can't have leadership in the world, regardless of how many weapons you have. You can't have leadership in the world without moral leadership. It's why the Soviet Union was never a serious leader in the world. It's why China historically has not been a leader in the world. People can be afraid of them. People can need their economic power. People might need the oil of Saudi Arabia, for example. But to exercise true leadership on this planet Earth, you have to have some measure of moral leadership. And we had that until George Bush came along, Bush Jr., and he has destroyed it. He's absolutely destroyed it.
If we're not a world power, then who is the world power?
Well, that's a good question, and I'll tell you, China thinks that they are going to be the world power in the 21st century, and it's going to take them 4 or 5 years to get to the point where they can kind of, take off the paper bag and say, ta-da, here we are. But
wow.
they're working on it. I wrote a chapter about this in my book, Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight, 10 years ago in the first edition of that book. There's a chapter in it about China. And from my experiences being in China, living in China in 1986, I only lived there for a month, but, I had some sense of what was going on in the country. And there was no doubt in my mind in the late 80s that China was trying to position themselves to overtake both the Soviet Union and the United States as the next world power, as the next, empire, as it were. And it is so obvious. I mean, just look at what they're doing economically. Look at what they're doing militarily. They've already faced us down with regard to Taiwan. They're building more and more missiles and pointing them at Taiwan. Taiwan is getting nervous and, more and more by the day. Look at what happened with Hong Kong. Hong Kong went from the British back to the Chinese in, 97, I believe. And,
right.
And the Chinese said, if we take back Hong Kong, we guarantee them independence. They'll have freedom. Don't worry. Everything's going to be fine. And, and they're suppressing democracy in Hong Kong. It's they really, we're not going to take them on. we're not going to take them on. And they've got, you know, and they've got a vote in the Security Council. It is a very, very, very difficult time for the United States to try to be any kind of a leader in the world. And it's one of the reasons why I think it's so important that the United Nations have strength and integrity, because there is a power vacuum out there. And if it's not filled by a group of nations working together in a rational and coherent way toward world peace, it's going to be filled by somebody working toward war.
Yeah, thanks, okay. Tom.
Thanks a lot, Logan. Good to hear from you. I appreciate the call. Bush has just created a whole world of trouble for us. And it's going to take a generation for America's reputation to be healed, just like it took a generation for Germany's reputation to be healed and other countries in the past that have done similar things. Tom Hartman here with you, 10 minutes before the hour.
Listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
So just because he wasn't really elected, just because that ballot count wasn't fair, just because him and all his friends are millionaires, don't care.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-889-8894. Our telephone number. By the way, we just got confirmation that tomorrow we're going to have George Galloway on, Member of Parliament in England, as a guest on the program. You never know how these things work out. It still could fall through, but I'm looking forward to that one. Joe in Provo, Utah, and driving a truck through Utah. Hey, Joe, what's up?
Hey, Tom, you're an education as always.
Occasionally I get educated. This thing about Priscilla Owen having already gotten a vote. Now, I remember now that there's been some of these folks have been referred to as the recycled candidates. I don't know why I didn't put two and two together. Anyway.
Yeah. Well, there's an article that I think portends the future for us. It was written by a professor of law at Harvard, James Moore. You might have come across it. It's called The Second Superpower.
Yeah.
Have you read
yeah,
that?
Yeah, a year ago.
About a year ago he came out with it, and it is so on, spot on. You know, I mean, when you take a look at the 10 million people that protested the war before this war, this conflict. I'm refusing to call it a war.
No.
Because we've not declared war.
No.
And as a Vietnam vet, I'm just, you know, so what did you think about that article? What were your thoughts about it?
My recollection is that they made a lot, the author of it made a lot of sense, but, you know, what's your point with regard to it?
Well, my point is, I mean, I don't know if you remember or not, but we started a party called the Being Human Party.
Mm-hmm.
And right now we're starting to get a feel for it for 2006 for my Senate campaign then. But more importantly, we've been talking with Chuck Panaccio down in Pennsylvania. You might be familiar with him.
Yep.
He's pushed aside, and we're going to try and support him and actually work with him to get his campaign going and get him in. He can run as a Democrat as far as we're concerned. The Being Human Party really is focused on what James Moore is talking about. We don't want to get into partisan politics. We don't want to be a third party. What we want to do is support candidates that are corporate and special interest free.
Yeah, well, that's a good plan, Joe, and I'm totally in favor of it. Our telephone number, 1-866-889-8894. We'll be back with more news. We've got a couple of interesting guests coming up and your calls after the news at the top of the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Check out this story about the Uzbek leader, Mr. Karimov, in China, in today's paper. It'll boggle your mind. Our allies, or Walmart's allies, or Chevron's allies. What's going on? What has happened to decency in international relationships? It's Tom Hartman with you, the place where smart people get their news.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Call calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, friends. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live coast to coast on radio stations from California to North Carolina, beaming down from outer space on the Sirius satellite radio system, streaming around the planet on WhiteRoseSociety.org, RadioPower.org, AmericanFM's Live365.com, and in 29 states on cable systems with CRN Digital. Welcome back to our program. Fiorina, Carly Fiorina, the former chairman, or president actually was her title, the former president of and CEO of Hewlett-Packard, has gave a speech at the Detroit Economic Club on Monday and came out and said, this is a different world than we imagined 5 years ago. That's pre-Bush Jr. Her message, they say, delivered with charisma and forcefulness, is what has made Fiorina a much desired speaker. You got a bunch of big corporations wanting to pay her big bucks to come speak. What is it that she had to say? She said, there is no job that is America's God-given right anymore. America must realize it is competing against countries that have to work and have the skills necessary to do the same jobs here. In other words, 6 billion humans on Earth, no national borders, no national boundaries, countries can't determine their own destiny, countries can't control their economy, and an economy should be run, Fiorina says, essentially, an economy should be run for the benefit of the owners of the means of production, as it were, and not for the people who live in that economy. Now, I would say the only thing standing between you and me and this kind of mentality completely capturing this nation and turning us into a feudal state, back to the robber baron era, are the unions. Democracy in the workplace. The unions in America. And one of the greatest organizations that is participating with the unions, the AFL-CIO, of course, and working with the AFL-CIO, the International Labor Communications Association, the ILCA, ILCA Online is their website. You want to check it out. And their president, Marty Fishgold, is with us. Hey, Marty.
Yeah, hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
I'm glad to have you here. This is pretty outrageous, what Fiorina is saying, and it's just, it's, you know, this kind of broad consensus that seems to be happening. You see all in the national media, the mainstream press, all the discussion about, you know, companies' net worth and all that, you know, stock prices and things, but they're not talking about what the average person is making. Only the labor press, only the labor media is talking about this. What's going on with labor media?
Well, Tom, you know, they probably want to turn this into another third world country.
They're doing it.
Yeah, I think they are. The labor media, you know, we're trying to promote delivering labor's message and how best to deliver that. Now, the message that's coming from labor is really the important thing.
Yeah.
The message has, I think, been interpreted as, in the past as being too self-serving. The ILCA, and myself in particular, are concerned about developing a national labor media strategy and developing a message that reaches out to a much broader constituency beyond the unions, so that people see that the unions, the power of the unions, are that we care about not just union members and their concerns, but about many other issues and poor people, people who are being messed up by this system. And I think we need a more spiritual and moral message that we need to get out there. And I would say that this message should be titled, "Greed is Not Okay." I think that's the critical message that we need to put out. Greed is not okay, and for many different reasons.
How about greed is not a moral value?
Well, maybe it's an immoral value.
Yeah, exactly. Greed is not a moral value. Here's another framing device you might want to consider, Marty, and that is, people consider democracy to be, you know, the abstract concept of democracy, they consider it to be a moral thing. They consider it to be, you know, family value. Democracy is just a word that sells really well. And
what unionization really is all about. What is workplace democracy? Democracy in the workplace. What unions promote is a balance of power in the workplace. Without unions, without organized labor, you have in the workplace basically a feudal system. A system, you know, F-E-U-D-A-L. You have a system where, you know, of lords and serfs. And with unions in the workplace, you have democracy. So why not start referring to the union movement as the democracy in the workplace movement?
Well, that's a good way to refer to the union movement. One of the things that the ILCA is concerned about, the labor communications, is that this current discussion within the labor movement between the AFL and the people that are opposed to the Sweeney administration, they're not discussing the labor media very much. They're not discussing the issue of how the labor media relates to organizing, it relates to politics, and we want to have this discussion. Media democracy has long been my main issue. I have tried to promote media democracy within the labor media. Unfortunately, the labor media and labor supports media reform in the commercial press and the commercial media. But it within its own ranks, it doesn't engage the membership enough. And so a national labor media strategy, one of the first things it would do would be to attempt to engage the membership so that the membership is not just organized, but as a membership, we can organize a lot more members, but if we have 35% of them voting for George W. Bush, who doesn't represent their economic interests, the organization isn't doing us any good. We need an informed membership, an educated membership, and that's why it's very important to get our union media to have letters to the editor, to have a dialogue, to have internal democracy within the unions to establish this. And I totally agree with you. The union movement is one of the last barriers between this capitalism eating us up and withstanding it. So we need to continue to support democracy in the workplace, but we also need to support internal democracy. Mm-hmm. We need to labor unions need to own and support national and local newspapers and magazines, television and radio stations, and radio programs like yours. We need to create a broad network of progressive media that will include independent media, media reaching people of color, foreign language media, community media. We need to get a broad reach and a network that can get a message out quickly, like the right does. Yeah. We are way behind them on this issue.
So how do you go about doing that, Marty Fishgold?
Well, this is a difficult problem, Tom. We're trying to enter into that debate now that's going on in the labor movement because there has been a bankrupt overall policy as far as the labor media is concerned. There has not been a grassroots support in the labor movement generally.
My sense of labor media historically has been that labor media is basically internal newsletters to members.
Well, that's true. It is to members, but you know, we need to not only, as I say, we need to not only tell our members who to vote for. We need to engage them in the discussion.
Yeah, or I'd say even not even so much tell them who to vote for, but tell them what the issues are. Once people figure out the issues, it's pretty obvious who to vote for.
Well, yeah, but in order for them to figure it out, the papers have to be exciting. The media has to be exciting. If it's not exciting, they're not going to read the papers. If it's just the president of the union telling them about the issues, if they don't have an opportunity to engage in a dialogue, they're not going to really get involved in it.
Yeah, good point.
They have to participate, and that's democracy. I mean, that's media democracy.
Yeah, excellent point. Marty, do you mind taking a call from a caller?
No, not at all.
Okay, our telephone number 1-866-889-8894. We're talking with Marty Fishgold, the president of the International Labor Communications Association, affiliated with the AFL-CIO. The ILCA Online is their website. And Tom in St. Paul, Minnesota on the line. Hey, Tom.
Marty, this is a take on what Tom was telling you. I introduced that term, democracy in the workplace, and then, actually that's my call sign on the chat room. And the reason I use that term, my wife is German, and she told me I have to enter this term into the echo chamber because in Europe, where the unions are 30-35% of the workforce, just like they were here in the heydays of the 60s, people in Europe understand that citizens, to have true democracy, can't just have it on the weekend. They got to have it in the workplace. And they use the term democracy in the workplace on everything, slogans, radio, you know, placards. You got to take that term because you're in a soundbite culture, and you got to hammer it over and over because it'll expose the cons. They don't believe in spreading democracy. You have to expose the hypocrisy and show, well, then let's have democracy where I work. And don't use workers. Use the term citizens, because they'll just say, oh, the Bolsheviks are coming. So you have to just use that term. It'll work for you.
Yeah, good point, Tom. Thank you for the call and for the comment. Marty?
Tom, my initial involvement in the union movement is because I worked in factories. I worked in factories in upstate New York. I saw people with their fingers cut off. I saw people fired for just questioning why a boss or an owner would do something. I've seen this lack of democracy in the workplace. And I think that what we really have to do, whatever the slogan is, and I think yours is fine, we have to get in touch with that anger, that outrage that people have, and focus it. We don't need the labor statesmen. We need labor leaders who have a mission and can get in touch with this, this strong feeling that people have that they're being mistreated.
Yeah, and the sense of democracy. I mean, if you were using the slogan "democracy in the workplace" to describe the union movement the way that they do in Europe, then every time George Bush talks about democracies on the march, he would be echoing your meme, your thought virus there.
Well, yeah,
something to consider.
I think that, yeah, it's whatever slogan we use, I think people have to understand what it means, you know,
and
that's the tough part.
So. Yeah, it always is. Framing the message is three-quarters of the work.
Right.
So, Marty, what can people who are not members of unions, but who support in general the idea of a more democratic workplace and a more egalitarian America, what can they do to participate in or support the kind of work that you're doing? We have about a minute and a half left here.
Well, Tom, I think that we need a mass movement. We have a convention coming up in Chicago, which you're going to be at on one of our plenaries on our labor media, and we invite people to contact us. They can contact the ILCA through our website or through our offices in Washington at 202-974-8037, and we want to help to organize a mass movement from the ground up. This is what this country needs. We have enough leaders. We need people to start acting, and we will totally support that. Workers in unions, workers out of unions, it doesn't matter to me. I mean, we will try to provide a voice for them.
That's absolutely great. Want to give the phone number one more time, Marty?
Yeah, it's our office in Washington is 202-974-8037, and you would contact our media coordinator, Alec Dubrow.
Great, who has been on this program quite often and fairly regularly.
Yeah.
Marty Fishgold, the president of ILCA, the International Labor Communications Association, ilcaonline.org, the website, one of the great organizations out there spreading the word about the union movement and about democracy in the workplace, democracy in America, about creating a more egalitarian nation. Marty, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you, Tom.
I do appreciate it. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, the place where smart people get their news, the radio support group of, by, and for we the people. Stick around. We'll be right back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Workplace democracy. Welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-889-8894. Our telephone number, tomhartman.com. If you want to drop into our live chat room, well populated now by folks literally from all over the planet. A fascinating conversation. And in fact, occasionally you get even interesting links. Ellen Ratner's with us, our correspondent from Washington, D.C., the bureau chief, the head cook and bottle washer, the big cheese at the Talk Radio News Service. Hey, Ellen.
Well, Tom, I want you to know that I was pushing your book today. Helen Thomas was talking about some of the comparisons with Germany, and I told her about your book this morning at the White House, and now she's all hot to get it.
Oh, great. Was that We the People? You mean the illustrated
book? We the People.
Yeah.
We the People.
Oh, great. Yeah, that's got a good chapter in there about
it. And I'll tell you, if she likes it, she'll write a nice column in her newspaper.
Well, I got to tell you, Helen Thomas is one of my heroes. So if you next time you speak with her,
when you come into town, maybe we'll try and have dinner.
That would be wonderful. That would be wonderful. She is just one of my, I can't overstate it. I mean, she is so courageous and such a competent, brilliant reporter.
Well, before I go into the material that's happened at Amnesty International, et cetera, I just want to tell you that, you know, supposedly we're fighting a war, right?
Yeah.
And it's happening in Iraq, and supposedly we're going to win this war. Well, this morning, Scott McClellan announced that they were doing a test of the emergency notification system so that, you know, if a bomb hits or something terrible happens, that those of us who are in the building, the White House, can get out of it.
Right.
Well, guess what? When that May 11th plane was coming near the White House, they thought, that little Piper Cub or whatever it was, they found out that the system was not operational. Somebody had not somehow turned on the system.
Oh, no.
Now, this is the White House.
This is just like during 9/11. There were no fighter planes.
Exactly. But they put the system in post 9/11 so that if these kind of things happen, we would all be warned and we could leave the building.
But it wasn't turned on.
That's right.
Amazing.
This is the same country that's fighting a war.
Amazing.
The other thing that happened at the gaggle, that's the morning pen and pencil briefing at the White House, is that embryos are now referred to as children embryos.
You're kidding.
No.
Children embryos.
That's right.
So are they going to start going into in vitro fertilization clinics where they routinely discard the extra fertilized eggs left over from when they prepare and put these people in jail?
That was exactly what was asked. And Scott said he would get back to us.
Yeah, right. They've gone over the edge.
You know, I used to work in mental health, and I thought yesterday when I went to the president's East Room speech on this embryonic stuff, and today I thought, you know something? I'm working in a madhouse.
Well, you know, it was 3 years ago that the White House gave $1 million to this conservative Christian adoption agency in Riverside, California, to create the Snowflake program to match up couples who were infertile with in vitro fertilization clinics who had leftover eggs, who's the parents of which, let's use their language for a moment, were willing to say, yes, donate those fertilized eggs.
Right.
And that is what produced these babies. And so the administration gave $1 million to a private agency. The private agency, you know, did this. Now, but this is nothing new. People have been doing, they have been getting embryos from other couples for 27 years. It's been going on. It's just all of a sudden now what they've done is they've packaged it and given it a name.
Right, and now we're going to all adopt embryos.
Yeah, it's outrageous.
As I was saying, is it like prunes? Is two too few to adopt? Is 50 too many to adopt? How do you know how many you should adopt?
Right, especially given that there's, you know, tens of thousands of them that are otherwise flushed down the drain every year all around the United States. And then at one point do they start, you know, putting people in jail, for example, for masturbation, for, you know, spilling, you know,
seed,
waste.
Seed,
yes.
Seed,
yeah, that's the biblical phrase. Don't spill your seed.
That's right.
Amazing. Well, Ellen, a good conversation. We'll solve the world's problems tomorrow.
You got to have a good one, Tom.
Thanks a lot for the call. Good to hear from you. It's the Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service. Tom Hartman here with you. 29 minutes past the hour. We'll be back with your calls and more right after this.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
Can't hear a shriek of bone and rolls in a vest. Told your brother Jeff would leave nothing to chance. Recount started, James
indeed, my friends. It's the White House crock. And welcome back, my friends. 26 minutes before the hour, 25 and a half minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone numbers. The place where progressives fiendishly plot for total world domination. Part of that plot, Tom, in Brandon, Oregon. Hey, Tom.
Yeah, Tom. Hey, I was reading your book, What Would Jefferson Do?
Yes, sir.
I was really galvanized by Chapter 4.
I don't recall which chapter was Chapter 4.
That's about the... comparison between Hitler's early rise.
Oh, and Bush's early rise.
Right.
Junior's, yeah.
Yeah, the historical perspective is just chilling.
Yeah, I thought it was, and that's why I had to write that. Because I lived in Germany for a year, and I had heard all those stories, and I had read Scheer's book, The Rise and Fall of the Third Reich. And I think that the generation of Americans, by and large, you know, from my age and younger, who don't remember World War II, have no actual recollection of those events, don't get it. You know, we don't teach that, you know, history at that level of detail, particularly third, you know, the history of Germany in our schools any longer. So the only people who really know that stuff are people who are, you know, history majors in college.
Right. Hey, could you reprint Chapter 4 as a pamphlet and make it available to your listeners?
It's on the web.
It is on the web.
Yeah. If you go to TomHartman.com and you click Articles on Democracy, it's in the upper right-hand corner. That'll take you to an archive of all the pieces that I've written for Common Dreams and whatnot. And then if you just scroll down, you'll find one called When Democracy Failed. And there's actually two versions of it. There's one that I wrote, which is that original chapter from 2 years ago, and it was published 2 years ago in Common Dreams first before it made its way into the book. And then there's another one that I published in February of this year that got a few extra paragraphs added to it, brings it up more up to date, you know, the parallels between the war in Iraq and Hitler's war against Poland, for example.
Oh, okay.
So.
Well, that's good.
TomHartman.com, click on Articles on Democracy, and the article you're looking for is titled When Democracy Failed.
Very good. Thank you.
You're welcome. Thanks for the call, Tom. Good
you
to
bet.
Hear from you. I appreciate it. And thanks for reading my book. My publisher appreciates that. Bob in Grand Rapids on the line. Hey, Bob, what's up?
Well, good afternoon, Tom. Yeah, I was watching TV yesterday and the different news reports, and maybe it's just the way I'm looking at it, but it seems to me as though the Republican Party is beginning to implode.
Yeah, and Frist looks like he's trying to pull things back together again here, but...
I don't think he can. I think there's been a realization there on the Republican side of the aisle that says, hey, wait a minute, we've been hoodwinked and we've been pulled around and we've been jerked around, and now we better stand up for ourselves and what's right or we're going bye-bye.
Well, it was at least 6 months ago that I first started saying that on this program, that the Republican Party is disintegrating and they just don't realize it yet, that it has factionalized. It has broken into factions, and the factions are mutually exclusive. You've got the religious faction, which really doesn't care about the economic part, unfortunately. I mean, tragically. You would think that people who call themselves Christians would care about the poor, but they, by and large, the religious faction is only obsessed with having money, government money going to the churches, and having the churches have a say in public morality. And then, number one. Number two, you've got the abortion faction, which is in some cases part of the religious faction, in other cases not. It's just, you know, these, like this Neil Horsley guy, the guy who has sex with mules and who publishes the website about how you can kill abortion doctors. I mean, you know, some of them are just extremists of some kind. I don't know what you could call them. And then you've got the economic so-called conservatives, and they break into two categories. You've got those who are supporting inherited wealth and who are working to end the inheritance tax and that sort of thing. You know, the empire, the oligarchists. And then you've got those who support multinational corporations, and you call them the internationalists. And they're at odds with the nationalist Republicans like Pat Buchanan, who say, you know, no, we shouldn't even be part of the UN because it should be, you know, U.S. for U.S. versus the internationalists who say, oh, yeah, give the whole thing to China. Who cares? And it's the party is just not able to hold itself together. There's no coherent philosophy that runs through it like there was in the days of Lincoln when it was a party of reform. It has essentially just become the party of whoever pays the largest bribe, and I use that word very intentionally. And the Democratic Party at least has a historical foundation of being the party of the working person. And if they would go back to their roots,
and set aside the, frankly, I think it's insanity that, Clinton et al. Started with this Democratic Leadership Council and go back to their roots and become the Democratic Party once again, and hopefully Howard Dean can make that happen. I think the Democratic Party has great potential, but Clinton did just incredible damage to the Democratic Party. They lost the House, they lost the Senate, they lost governor's races all over the United States. The only person who got reelected because of Clinton was Clinton.
Yep. Did you notice yesterday, I know you had to, how the House and the Senate are going up against Bush on embryonic stem cell research?
Yeah.
That just absolutely amazed me that they would even dare stand up to him and the extreme religious right when it comes to that.
Well, you had, I forget the name of the Republican congressman. There were three Republican congressmen who historically had been very, very strong pro-life, you know, in quotes, strong anti-abortion guys, who came out in favor of the stem cell thing. And one of them, in his statement, he said, in fact, he started crying as he was saying it. I don't know if you saw the clip on TV. He was talking about he doesn't want to see another 6-year-old or 8-year-old or whatever, another 7 or 8-year-old die from from juvenile diabetes, type 1 diabetes. And what he was talking about was they held hearings on this issue. And this kid came and testified before this guy's committee and said, you know, that he was dying and that this technology held the potential to save his life. And he said, you know, Congressman, you hold my life in your hands. Please don't let me die. And it really made an impression.
Well, Tom, I just wanted to let you know how it looked to me from my perspective, and I hope that what I've seen is true.
I think it is, Bob, and I appreciate your sharing that with us. Thanks for calling
in.
Well,
have a good day, sir.
You too. Thank you very much for calling. Good to hear from you. 19 minutes before the hour. Just to follow on Bob's observation, this from The Guardian. Now, you know, why this is not... This is the UK's Washington correspondence. This is a story originating out of Washington, D.C., but it is not appearing in American newspapers. This is, how to say this? The media is so obsessed with what they call human interest stories. You know, is it cute? Basically, if it bleeds, it leads, and if it's cute, it follows. You know, it's a bleeding story and cute stories are what they're all about. And you would think that this would be a cute story, what I'm about to share with you. You know, the kind of story, oh, isn't that ironic? That it would be in USA Today today, and it would be in the New York Times, and, you know, that kind of thing. The guy, the politician, Walter Jones, Republican congressman from North Carolina, the Republican politician in the United States, who renamed French fries and French toast as Freedom Fries and Freedom Toast, and pushed through the effort to codify that in the House of Representatives in the cafeteria there. Walter Jones, Republican congressman from North Carolina, the brains behind French toast becoming Freedom Toast and French fries becoming Freedom Fries, has come out against the war in Iraq. As the Independent notes in the UK, although he voted for the war, he has since become one of its most vociferous opponents on Capitol Hill, where the hallway outside his office is lined with photographs of the, quote, faces of the fallen, end quote. In fact, he said, this from the congressman who named Freedom Fries, Walter Jones, Republican of North Carolina, quote, if we were given misinformation intentionally by people in this administration to commit the authority to send boys and in some instances girls to go to Iraq, that is wrong. We must be told, Congress must be told the truth. This guy is righteously upset. He is fried, speaking of French fries. So I thought that's particularly ironic. Here you see, as was pointed out just a few moments ago, the Republican Party coming unglued, coming unfrayed. And why? Because it's really not a party anymore. The Republican Party is not a party. It's a coalition of fringe extremist groups, economic extremists, what do you call it, religious extremists, anti-abortion extremists, and perhaps the scariest in the bunch, the anti-liberty extremists, the police state extremists. And they've held together because their interests, you know, it's been the I'll scratch your back, you scratch mine kind of thing. Their interests in some areas coincide, or at least they haven't considered them to be mutually exclusive. Oh, and then there's the gung-ho go-to-war extremists, the military-industrial complex extremists. And the great wealth extremists, the Richard Mellon Scaife-type extremists. And they've sort of held together as, you know, well, you know, if we're all in power, then we're all in power. But then you see where, you know, earlier in this week, John Engler, the former governor of Michigan, head of the National Association of Manufacturers, comes out in an internal publication. I mean, you know, talking to their members. They're doing this quietly. This isn't, you know, hey, let's hold a press conference and tell the New York Times about it. This is talking to their members. But here you have John Engler, the former Republican governor of Michigan and now chairman or president of the National Association of Manufacturers, getting together and saying, you know, I don't think this idea, I'm paraphrasing, of course, I don't think this idea of getting into bed with the religious right and going to the mattresses about judges is such a good plan. That's not our fight. And he's right. So while with the Democratic Party, at least historically, you have a tradition going all the way back to Thomas Jefferson, who founded the Democratic Party, of it being the party of the average working person. Thomas Jefferson was the one who argued so strongly that the Senate should be directly elected by we the people, and the Federalists, the Republicans of their day, John Adams and Alexander Hamilton and that bunch, said, no, the Senate must be appointed. They must be aristocrats. We should have an aristocracy in America. And they got their way. The Senate wasn't actually elected in the United States until 1917. So, or was it 1919? One of those 2 years. Anyway, so this is the, you know, the Democratic Party has this long history of being the party of the working people, the party of the average American. And that's why it keeps coming back. It's like the Energizer Bunny. It's the longest lived political party in the history of the world. And for good reason. It has a powerful and noble tradition. And I think that, you know, if enough of us who are progressives and activists can get inside it and take it over and participate in it, we can actually turn the Democratic Party back into the Democratic Party. But step one, in my opinion, is to tell the folks within the Democratic Party who are really Republican lights that they should go to the Republican Party. And they should take over the Republican Party, because the Republican Party really needs some good old-fashioned Republicans. They need the Barry Goldwaters and the Everett Dirksons and the Dwight Eisenhowers and the Nelson Rockefellers. They desperately need them. The Republican Party needs a moral compass. The Republican Party needs somebody within it who has some vision of what the party was and what the party could be. Because the Republican Party has become the party of corruption, bribery, and scandal. I mean, Ronald Reagan had more senior officials in his administration convicted of major felonies than any administration in the history of the United States. And I guarantee you that if there was a Democratic House or Senate, you'd have the same thing going on with this Bush administration, because it's equally as corrupt as the Reagan administration was. The Republican Party really needs to get its moral compass together. They need another, you know, another Barry Goldwater, who many considered an extremist of his time, but he was a strongly moral guy. Here's Barry Goldwater, who said the government has no business in your bedrooms. The government has no business legislating morality. The government has no business, Barry Goldwater, you know, the government has no business even determining what substances you use in the privacy of your own home. You know, why don't the libertarians take over the Republican Party and the liberals take over the Democratic Party, and let's just let the fringe cases go back to being fringe cases like they historically were. Speaking of fringe cases, Don Rumsfeld, it turns out, on May 11th, remember the small plane came over the Capitol? Two private pilots, an instructor, and a terribly, terribly lost student. Well, it turns out that it was important enough for somebody to give the order to shoot that thing down, and they did. It wasn't important enough for that person to be the president of the United States. Don Rumsfeld gave the order to shoot the plane down, and they came within 20 seconds of it. This just in the Washington Post today. Donald Rumsfeld gave military officials the authority to shoot down a small plane that wandered into, if necessary, a small plane that wandered into restricted airspace over the nation's capital May 11th, according to two senior federal officials. Rumsfeld. But Bush, he was on his bicycle. Don't interrupt the president when he's riding his bicycle, please. It's like interrupting him when he's reading My Pet Goat. You just don't do that, because then you get the vacant stare, and that's bad press. It looks bad on television. We don't want people, and Michael Moore might be around with a camera, you never know, and that could be very embarrassing. It would, you know, another movie like that. We don't need another Fahrenheit 9/11 movie. So don't tell the president, and that way there won't be an opportunity for him to give you that deer in headlamps look. So Don Rumsfeld stepped into the breach and said, I'll take over this. Shoot him down! And then the question is, okay, you shoot him down, what are they going to land on? 10 minutes before the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back.
I get up every morning and ignore the global warming. Head out to the Oval Office, start my day.
Oh, it's Georgie's song.
My donors are protected so I can be re-elected. Give them access just as long as they pay. And to the corporate crooks who keep cooking up the books, we make sure we look the other way. The laws are theirs to break, long as I still get my take. My war chest keeps on growing each day. And I've been taking care of business.
Yes, indeed, George Bush taking care of nothing but business. Welcome back, Tom Hartman here with you for 11 intense minutes. Customs aircraft and military fighter jets tried to intercept the Cessna 150. Military officials never deemed the aircraft to be hostile, writes the Washington Post. Spencer Sue and John Mintz in the Washington Post. However, this is me speaking, not the Washington Post. However, Donnie Rumsfeld got so terrified, he said, shoot that thing down. There is such fear in this administration. And they are driven by terror, and they're trying to drive us by terror. I mean, if you want to go with a strict definition of the word terrorist, those who spread terror, at least the real participants in terror seem to me the folks who were telling Tom Ridge, even though he was saying, you know, I really don't see a threat here, telling Tom Ridge, it's time to raise the alert. So, you know, he came out last week and he said, you know, they kept raising the alerts when I told them there wasn't a threat. And have you heard any right-wing bloviators on talk radio ranting about that? I don't think so. No, because it was politically useful. Every time John Kerry got some good publicity, raise the alert. Democrats are meeting in for their convention, raise the alert. Bad news for Republicans, raise the alert. Paul Craig Roberts, who I shared a story with you yesterday, this is from 2003, Town Hall, townhall.com, the website from William F. Buckley, Jr. Opening sentence, the Republican Party will not survive its invasion of Iraq, its commitment to open borders, and its pandering to preferred minorities. He's absolutely spot on right. He said, you know, it's just attacking Iraq will destabilize the Middle East. This was all before the attack. He's saying, don't do it. And he's going on to say, it will bring down the Republican Party. And sure enough, it is doing it. Tom Hartman here with you. Transforming the world by restoring democracy to the United States of America.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live on radio stations from California to West Virginia, streaming down from outer space on the Sirius satellite radio system, coast to coast, border to border, and beaming around the planet on RadioPower.org, WhiteRoseSociety.org, Live365's American FM, and on cable systems in 29 states on CRN Digital. Welcome back to our program. ESNS, the big voting machine company, you may recall from previous conversations, in a previous incarnation, the company was headed up by Chuck Hagel, the fellow who had, prior to that, worked for well over a decade for George Bush Sr., and then went to Nebraska, was recruited by what is now ESNS to run the voting machine company. Ran that company, sold the voting machines to the state of Nebraska, and then quit his job as CEO and ran for the United States Senate, billing himself not as a voting machine company president, but as an investment banker. The people of Nebraska voted however they voted. We will never know because it was all ESNS machines that recorded the vote. What we do know is that Chuck Hagel won in what the Washington Post called the landslide upset of the year. And he won in districts that had never before a Republican had won in. In black districts, for example, Chuck Hagel won, where, you know, according to Bev Harris's analysis of this. So then, as soon as Chuck Hagel went off to the United States Senate, the Republicans in Nebraska passed a law saying that it's illegal to audit the machines. Believe it or not, if you go to TomHartman.com, click Articles on Democracy, and click on The Theft of Your Vote is Just a Chip Away, if you want the whole story, or if you want to steal an election, just own the voting machines, either one of those two articles. So in any case, this is kind of the history of ESNS. Now, new stories about ESNS coming out, which I find fascinating. Joan, is it Krawitz?
That's right.
Hey, Joan Krawitz and John Gideon. Hey, John.
Hi.
John Gideon with us with Vote. TrustUSA.org, and John has written a fascinating article. Does ESNS really want to sell the AutoMark machines? And John, I have to say, as a writer myself and an editor, if just a small suggestion, it seems to me that you buried the lead. The last two paragraphs of your story are what people should read first. And in fact, if you're reading the story at VoteTrustUSA.org, I encourage you to go to read the last two paragraphs because it really raises the question: why is ESNS apparently trying to get particular precincts, particular certain areas of the United States, to buy machines sold by a vendor that they are, what, merging with or they have some business with, who make machines that produce no paper trail? Is that the bottom line here, John?
Yeah, that is exactly the bottom line. Thanks for your comment, by the way. I'm not a writer. In previous incarnation, I was just a machinist.
Well, you did a great job of writing this thing and pulling together all the details. I mean, it's marvelously well done and well written. I didn't. The light bulb didn't go off for me until I read the last two paragraphs, until I got to the end, and that's the point at which I thought, well, these really need to be in the beginning. But not, you know, I don't want to turn this into a critique of your writing. But that really is the bottom line, and that's how did this come about?
It came about, I live in Chicago, and we went into, I suppose, Trust USA. We went to the Cook County Elections Division and had a meeting with several of the higher-ups in that department to discuss their purchase of machines and to advocate, in fact, for a type of accessory to optical scan systems that's called the AutoMark. It's a generally reasonably priced touchscreen adaptation that actually marks a regular optical scan ballot. So anybody can use it, including blind and handicapped
voters. It's basically a computer touchscreen that operates as a printer. And what it prints out is the ballot, and that's the actual ballot that then gets scanned and read, right?
That's correct.
Okay.
And it can be used just for the disabled group within that precinct, And everyone else can use a regular optical scan ballot, and it can be scanned in the normal way, too.
Right, and everybody else can vote on paper if they want.
And everybody votes on paper, and it should be considerably cheaper to do it that way.
Yeah.
We had a long meeting, but one of the outcomes was they said they were very familiar with AutoMark, but they weren't about to buy it because it was $6,500 a machine. We went back and reported this, and John can pick up the story from there.
Okay, John, $6,500 a machine for a machine that actually seems like it might generate a paper trail and ensure a relatively clean election to the extent that that can be ensured with these machines. And then what happened?
Well, besides what the advantages that you mentioned, it also will load up to 9 languages, including state of Arizona wants them because they can load pictographs and allow Native Americans who speak a language that isn't even a written language, and they can vote. So, I mean, they're really amazing machines. But I knew from previous articles that I had read, news articles, that there was a problem in New York State, where the legislature had been bandying about what kind of system they were going to use, and they were leaning toward a DRE system.
DRE meaning a
direct recording electrical. Those are the touchscreen voting machines
that produce no paper trail.
That's right.
Yeah, and in fact, by the way, let me just toss in here, just, you know, in the news, Mayor Michael Bloomberg says that when the city buys new electronic voting machines, he doesn't think they'll be necessary for them to have a paper trail. This from New York News 1, Channel 1 in New York. The mayor said the technology is advanced enough these days the paper backups aren't necessary. He says, I would do it personally without a paper trail. He says, everything is controlled by computers and they're phenomenally reliable. This from a guy who's a billionaire and who, I don't know, does he own stock in the voting machine companies or what? I mean, you know, casinos are run by computers, too, and we all know that they're rigged.
That's
in favor
true.
Of the house.
And the interesting thing is that this seems to be a new talking point. I noticed someone else being quoted saying exactly the same thing yesterday.
Oh, that's interesting.
So that's the latest.
He says, on the airplane, on the subway, in your car, you don't even turn on lights and water without a computer. He said everything is controlled by computers. So therefore, we should just, this is insane.
Right.
Okay, so,
well, if there were a computer that was only being used once every 4 years that would determine the fate of the world, and it was easy to hack or to sell access to, I don't think that plane would make it to where it was supposed to go.
There you go. And it's not an if. It's a, this is what we're really talking about here.
That's
talking with Joan Krawitz and John Gideon of VoteTrustUSA.org. So, John, the machines in Chicago, the Chicago wasn't going to buy because they were $6,500. Why weren't they, you know, what alternative was there?
Well, the alternative is to go with the technology that ES&S would prefer to sell, which is their DRE machines, their touchscreen voting machines, paperless voting machines, or what they're going to have in the future whenever it gets through all the testing. They're supposed to have some type of a printer. Now, Illinois requires a paper ballot of some type or paper audit trail, whatever the terminology is in their law. So they are hedging a bet, pricing the AutoMark machines up so that they can sell their DRE machines.
Do they also sell the AutoMark machines?
Yes.
Oh, okay, so you've got the same company, but it sounds like the AutoMark machine is doing more than a DRE. I mean, a DRE is not generating a paper trail, and so it doesn't have a printer attached to it, so it makes sense that it would be a little less expensive, right?
Let me be clear that the AutoMark machine, it was not made, developed, or anything by ES&S. It was made by a completely separate company, what used to be Vogue Elections, and has now spun off to AutoMark Technical Services. They made the machine.
But they have a marketing agreement with ES&S.
They have a marketing agreement with ES&S.
Okay, so the point of all this, to boil this down, is that it at least, let me tell you what it sounds like to me that you're saying, and you tell me if that's what you're saying from reading this and from talking with you here. It sounds to me like what you're saying is that ES&S is using very selectively the pricing of their machinery to, in particular, in some areas, to try to encourage the use of paperless machines, no paper trail machines, and discourage the use of machines that generate a paper trail. Is that what you're suggesting?
Yes, in big markets, New York State and Cook County, Illinois, they seem to be discouraging the sale of AutoMark. In fact, in New York, where they said that New York State is a DRE state, that came from the president of ES&S and from their lobbyists in the state, which was a big surprise to state legislators.
New York is a Democratic state. Georgia was a Democratic state until they put the DREs in, and all of a sudden it became a Republican state.
Oh, there you go. That's certainly an
option. So, I mean, you know, this is, but we're straying into the realm of conspiracy theory here, I think, and couldn't it just be that these machines are more expensive? Or in other markets, are they pricing the paper machines at a lower price than the DREs?
And we know from a phone call to South Dakota, which just contracted to buy AutoMark machines, we know that they bought the machines, including table and other peripherals, for $5,400 per unit. We know that
which is below the cost of the DREs.
Yeah, by
so in those markets where it doesn't matter, and in small markets, they're perfectly willing to sell a paper-based machine at a low price, at even a lower price than their DRE machines. But in those markets, those big markets, and in those big states that tend to vote heavily Democratic, they're pushing paperless machines, and they're changing their pricing. Is that what you're suggesting?
There you go. That's exactly right.
Okay, fascinating. Dave in Eureka, California on the line. Let's take a few callers here. Dave in Eureka, California on the line. Hey, Dave, what's up?
Good morning, folks. To me, it is so unforgivable that just a few thugs in our Congress are blocking all efforts to make these machines verifiable and honest. A question for you, though. Can you estimate the number of machines that we have? How much would another party have to win by before, if those are all rigged? And I believe they are.
Okay, good question, Dave. And we have about a half a minute.
Now, I don't think it's possible to estimate that all types of machines can be rigged. And one of the keys here is to get, at a minimum, right away, the ability to hand audit and a mandate to hand audit at least a random percent of the vote,
which requires
in every district.
Yeah, which requires a paper trail. So,
which always requires a paper trail.
So, for example, like in Georgia, when they said that all of a sudden the Republicans won and the Democrats didn't, even though the polls were all showing the Democrats, you know, Max Cleland, for example, winning, you can't audit it. Sorry, it's electrons on a chip. But don't worry, Mayor Bloomberg says they're reliable.
That's
so
correct.
Yeah,
let me get in. Anyone who would like to come to D.C. to lobby for verifiable voting, please go to workingassets.org and click on Take Action.
Great. Workingassets.org, click on Take Action. Also, votetrustusa.org. Joan Krawitz and John Gideon, thanks so much for being with us. I do appreciate it today.
Thank you very much.
It's the Tom Hartman Program, 20 minutes past the hour.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
I was making my way through the wasteland. The road is,
and welcome back. Making our way through the wasteland of what's left of democracy in the United States. Shredded. The Constitution shredded by George W. Bush Jr. and his buddies. Taking apart the Patriot Act yesterday. Oh, no, we don't need any judges involved. The FBI, they were actually arguing before Congress yesterday, and they're going to go into private secret session later in the week to mark up the Patriot Act. They were actually arguing that police agencies like the FBI should not any longer have to go to a judge and prove that there is probable cause before they break into somebody's house or before they get they acquire somebody's papers. Somebody's personal possessions. I had a guest on from the ACLU on my morning show on KPOJ, just laying it out. They actually argued before the Congress that the Fourth Amendment to the United States Constitution, which clearly says that if you are going to, that if the police agency or the government is going to investigate you, if they're going to look at your papers, if they're going to look into your home, that they have to have probable cause. They have to believe a crime was committed, and it has to be sworn under oath by somebody before a judge, and then that judge has to issue a warrant. And now they are saying, no, we don't need the Fourth Amendment anymore. Forget it. Believe it or not. 1-866-889-8894. Telephone number, Paul in Detroit on the line. Hey, Paul, what's up?
Hello, Tom. Tomorrow, could you please ask the British MP, George Galloway, to comment on his testimony being purged from the U.S. Senate Permanent Subcommittee for Investigation Records?
Yeah, Paul, you couldn't stop me from asking him that.
Oh, that's got to be really...
Assuming that we can actually get him. It's all set up, but you just never know with these things, you know? So I don't, you know, anyway,
and,
yeah, go ahead.
And one more quick thing. I've placed on your radio show program message board a link to the BBC World News that gives instant download of his entire testimony before that subcommittee.
You mean a video, or is it
a video?
Oh, cool.
And I've got that. I've put that link on your message board under your radio program.
That's marvelous.
And testimony comes within the first few moments of the video, so you don't have to wait through the whole 47 minutes of it.
Yeah.
And what an inspiring attack he made on our system of government.
Well, let's back up a little bit. He didn't make an attack on our system of government. Our system of government is just fine. He made an attack on the people who are corrupting our system of government.
This administration.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Who have twisted into knots our system of government in such a way as to render it almost undistinguishable. I would say that George Galloway is probably a grand advocate of democracy in a republic, that he's all in favor of that, but not the way the Bushies are doing it.
Also, maybe possibly the flaw of our two-party system.
Yeah, well, that's I think evident for all to see. The problem is, what do you do to fix it? Basically, we're not going to get a parliamentary proportional representation system like they have in the UK. So the only alternative is to do what Australia and New Zealand did, which is launch or implement national instant runoff voting, IRV. And that's something that, you know, we need to be working on here. I doubt, you know, Galloway is an expert on those kind of things, but, I think I'll stick with him to the war.
Everybody, please watch the video on Tom's message board. You'll be just a flabbergasted, and it can be sent to friends, too. There's a link to send it to anybody you want from the BBC.
Oh, cool. Okay, you can get that, by the way. Thanks, Paul, for the call. I appreciate it. You can get that by going to TomHartmann.com and clicking on the blog/message board. And then Paul says it's in the area that's labeled Tom's radio show, or the national radio show. And so there should be a link there. By the way, if you want to contact Mayor Michael Bloomberg and tell him that you think he's nuts to suggest that voting technologies don't need paper trails, which is, he actually came out and said on his radio show last Friday, you can call him, area code 212-788-3000. Ask for the comment line. 212-788-3000. If you want to tell Mayor Michael Bloomberg where he can... What? No, I'm not going to say it. If you want to tell him how he should consider this issue. 29 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartmann Program.
Acid rain is not a problem, said a businessman.
No problem.
But all the fish are belly up and floating round.
Oh, it is a problem.
And there's nothing growing from the ground. Just ask Farmer Brown. On the corner are some activists with picket signs. They want the factories to stop their filthy ways. But the government says it's okay, it'll go away any day. Acid rain is up my nose and in my eyes.
Ah, yes, acid rain in my eyes.
Poison fish polluted skies, it makes my flowers die. Acid rain, the baby.
Welcome back, my friends. 25 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here. Some of these bumpers are just so great. It's just absolutely fascinating. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. And before we get to your calls, Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service back with us today. Hey, Ellen.
Well, we actually just got the full report from Amnesty International, and I just had to call you back because I was so incensed.
I am so glad you did.
Do you know how many people, at least according to Amnesty International now, this was not necessarily in the autopsy, how many people were killed by tasers?
In the United States?
In the United States by U.S. police officers.
The last I heard was it was in the neighborhood of 50-plus over the last year.
It's 40. It's 40, 40 this
okay.
year. That's right. You've got a better statistic than I do. And this is 40 people died after being struck. Only 5 of those did they find that the tasers played a role because they said, well, they were intoxicated or this, that, or the other.
Yeah. Guy would have had a heart attack anyway. It was just going to happen any minute now.
Exactly. So that they are now, of course, in more than 5,000 U.S. police and correctional agencies.
Yeah.
And the other thing that they talked about was this execution. Now, I've thought I pretty much follow executions, but there was one on August 5th by a James Hubbard in Alabama.
You mean of a James Hubbard?
Of a James Hubbard
right.
in Alabama.
Uh-huh.
He was 74 years old, and he had dementia, which had him forget who he was and why he was on death row.
And they put him to death anyway.
That's right.
Well, I guess it's cheaper. That's got to be their rationalization. I mean, you know, this is the thing.
We heard about Kelsey Patterson, who had a paranoid schizophrenia in Texas.
Right.
But
my point is, this is the crowd who says that they're all about a culture of life, Ellen.
Right.
And but they'll put somebody to death who doesn't even know who he is.
And Victoria went to the afternoon briefing at the White House. We usually split up, and I go to the morning. She goes to the afternoon, and again. The child embryos came up, and again, actually, Victoria asked the artificial insemination question of, well, what happens to those extra embryos that aren't used? They get thrown away. Should they be adopted? And again, all he would do is talk about his culture of life.
Yeah, well, I think the bigger question is, what about those extra embryos that get fertilized and are then thrown away? Is the lab worker who throws them down, who washes out the petri dish so they go down the sink, even though they're invisible, I mean, they're smaller than the period at the end of a sentence, is that person guilty of murder, and should they be taken off to the Texas execution room, strapped down, and have a needle put in their arm?
Well, if they're a child embryo,
right.
maybe they qualify.
Hey, it's if it's child murder, you know, put them to death. It's I had one of these guys when we were doing the radio row from the Republican National Committee, and it was just great. You were feeding me all these wonderful guests, and they were all Republicans. And I had one of these guys come over and sit down, and he thought I was another one of the right-wing shows because there was, like, you know, 40 right-wing shows all around me and then me. And he sits down, and he's all smiling, and I said, you know, so what's your thing? And he's like, you know, well, we're, you know, opposed to abortion and in favor of culture of life. And I said, great. Do you know, for women who get abortions, do you think that they should be executed by hanging or by lethal injection? And he said, well, I think that's up to the state.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. With a completely straight face. He thought he was on a conservative talk show. That's
right.
That's up to the state. You know? It's like...
I thought you were never going to guess near how many people died from the tasers.
Well, I saw a news report or heard a news report about it. So it's not a secret. It's just it's not well known. I don't think
right.
the average American
and
has
I
any
nearly,
idea.
And I nearly when I read the report. And what's so fascinating when you go to the report, you know, the United States has like 3 pages, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you go to Canada, and there's hardly
it's like a sentence,
right?
You know, there's some guy in a prison someplace, and they forgot to feed him lunch.
Right.
In Canada.
Now, they had 6 people die using a taser gun, so they are using them there.
Okay.
But that is about it. And then, of course, there was the Aurora case in Canada, of the Canadian who went to Syria. That's my brother's case. But other than that,
right.
You know,
I'm curious.
Their big concern is 6 people dying. With the taser gun, which is not, you know, I mean, they have a smaller population there.
Right.
But we have pages.
pages. Well, this is where I'm curious, Ellen. Does Amnesty International rank countries? Are we like, 22nd in the world or 9th in the world?
Freedom House ranks the fact that we're 29th of the free world in terms of freedom of the press?
Which is really strange because Freedom House is run by Mark, what's his last name? I'm forgetting. He's a former Republican ambassador to Hungary, as I recall.
Exactly.
I had him on my program, in fact, about a year ago. Because he'd written a book about this stuff, and he's basically a neocon. And yet they're saying the United States is 29th in the, but in any case, does Amnesty International rank countries?
There does not seem to be a ranking, no.
Yeah.
In their book, they go through pretty much every country, and no.
Who had more than three pages? Were there a lot of countries with more than three pages?
The United Kingdom does pretty well. They've got even looks like they're actually
competing with us.
They're certainly not quite as long as we are, but I guess they're as long as we are. They talk about some police shootings, and I didn't think Bobby's there. And they of course talk about Northern Ireland, there's quite a bit. Actually, Spain has quite a bit, and then you have some places that are relatively decent. France does not seem to be top of the hit parade here. That's interesting. By the way, one other question that I forgot to tell you about that Helen asked the president this morning.
Helen Thomas got to ask?
Not the president. I'm sorry.
I was going to say, I didn't think George would do it.
He
won't take a question from Helen.
He won't.
Yeah. He's afraid of her.
Well, he won't allow me to ask a question either.
Yeah, he's afraid of you, too. He's afraid of anybody who might ask him a hard question.
That's right. Well, it turns out that they asked him this morning, they asked Scott about why there was, in fact, an occupation of, was there really an occupation, or were we invited in to Iraq and Afghanistan? And Scott said, well, we had been invited in, and that these countries had freely elected governments that were inviting us in. I went, wait a minute.
Yeah. Yeah, well, we said the same thing about South Vietnam.
Right.
There are some parallels here.
Right.
It's not
quite an invitation. Hey. I wonder if Saddam sent us an engraved one.
I don't know. Ellen, a real quick question. If you were able to ask George Galloway any question, what would it be?
Well, gosh, what would I ask George Galloway? I mean, I've listened to all that testimony. We have it on our website.
Mm-hmm. Your website, by the way, is?
TalkRadioNews.com.
Okay.
And I think I would want to ask him, in his calculation, so where did the $8.8 billion go that we spent? I mean, he said it went to Halliburton, et cetera, but where exactly? How does he think it would break down?
Yeah. Okay. Good. That's a good question. Thank you, Ellen.
You're welcome.
And I look forward to talking with you tomorrow.
You got it.
Okay, have a good one. It's Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service with a report today. It's always so great to hear from Ellen. She has just the juiciest stuff. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. Mike in Washington, D.C. on the line. Hey, Mike, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom. Welcome to another day in Stalin's America.
Well, it's not. We're not quite there. I mean, the reality is that Stalin was worse than George is on his worst days. We're just moving in the wrong direction.
Well, it took Stalin a while to get there, too, remember?
Yeah, but he started out killing people. Well, so did George, actually, come to think of
exactly.
It.
Exactly. No, what I'm saying is, you remember a little ditty we learned as little kids about yesterday upon the stair I saw a man who wasn't there?
No, I never learned that ditty.
You're kidding.
No, sorry.
Yesterday upon the stair, I saw a man who wasn't there. I saw him there again today. I wish to hell he'd go away.
No, I don't know that one.
But the whole point is, you were talking about George Galloway. Uh-huh. He testified before the Senate, did he not?
He did, yes. And according to
not.
The... According, yeah, exactly. According to the way things are supposed to operate, when people testify before the Senate, there's a stenographer there who's banging away like a court reporter, and the stuff gets put in the record of Senate testimony.
It's not there.
It's not there. Have you looked recently? Because this was a big news story 3 or 4 days ago that it had been purged. And I figured, every day I should go back and just check and see if it's there. And, maybe Tony, what's his name? Maybe, or Norm Coleman, rather, got so embarrassed that he just kind of slipped it in and, that he was being, hassled for not having it there. Have you checked recently?
No, I haven't. But yeah.
Maybe somebody in our chat room will check it out, because that would be a good question to find out. Is Galloway's testimony still purged from the official Senate website where they show the record of the testimony before the Senate? I'd like to know if today it's still gone. So
hopefully somebody will check it out. You heard about Simple Scotty yesterday, correct?
It depends on which Simple Scotty question you're talking about. You're talking about the one where he said, the way that we know that we're winning is because they're killing more of us?
No.
That was the one that really baffled me. He said, in Iraq, the way that we know, I'm paraphrasing, but he said, essentially, the way that we know that we're winning the war is that they're killing more of us, because that means that they're really frustrated and they're really upset because they're losing. And so the more Americans who die, and the worse it is for the United States, that means, that's proof, that's more and more proof that we're winning, and we should be very happy about that.
No, I didn't hear that one. That's another bit of lunacy.
Yeah, and the question in my mind is, how do you know when you're losing?
Exactly. No, the point I want to bring out is somebody actually asked him about the Downing Street memo.
Yeah.
And his response was, that's nothing new. We didn't cover anything up. All you need to do is go back over the official statements, and you can see how we use the intelligence.
Right, and you can.
And
you can. You can see where they lied. You can see where they twisted things. You can see where they took things out of correct context. You can see where they distorted things.
Right.
So, you know, Scotty's telling the truth for a change.
Last night, Mike Malloy had an 8-minute segment where he had all these wonderful statements, you know, mainly about the WMDs and so forth and so on. All the lies that they came up with, the aluminum tubes, the yellow cake, blah, blah, blah. And yet, that's exactly what the Downing Street memo says. They were fixing
I know.
The intelligence.
Yeah, they were fixing the thing.
Of it.
I agree with you, Mike, and I appreciate the call. It's good to hear from you. But it's, you know, there you go. They did it. They got away with it. And time will tell whether they continue to get away with it. This is one of the big questions. Here you have this piece, this on townhall.com. And it's still there. I mean, I'm reading it off the website right now. If you go to townhall.com and do a search within that site on Paul Craig Roberts, you'll find this archived. It's called Iraq, the Last Republican Hurrah. And he wrote this on January 29th, 2003. That was 3 months before the invasion of Iraq. This was back when the Republicans, when Bush was still saying, I don't know if we've made up our mind yet. Now, keep in mind, this was 6 months after the Whitehall memo said Bush has already decided he's going into Iraq and they're fixing the intelligence around the policy. So here, Paul Craig Roberts, a former editor with the Wall Street Journal and contributing editor to numerous conservative publications, including Town Hall. I'm looking at an ad for Newt's book and now Ann Coulter's book on this very page, right? Conservative books. He says, the Republican Party will not survive its invasion of Iraq, its commitment to open borders, and its pandering of preferred minorities. And he goes on to say, an invasion of Iraq is likely the most thoughtless action in modern history. It has the support of only two overlapping small groups. Neoconservatives infused with the spirit of 18th century French Jacobians who want to impose American exceptionalism on the rest of the world. And foreign policy advisors who believe that the primary aim of U.S. foreign policy is to make the Middle East safe for Israel. This is very politically incorrect. He goes on to say, no one else sees the point of the impending conflict. Well, I would say he missed the oil folks. You know, there's the oil folks. And he also missed the folks who think that having George W. fight a war will get him reelected. I mean, that's the key to the whole thing. If you go back and look, he keeps asking, you know, what is the invasion all about? The administration's answer strains credulity. Iraq has weapons of mass destruction that threaten the United States. These weapons are yet to be discovered by the UN inspectors who are combing the country. Keep in mind, this is when Hans Blix was in the country. The paucity of evidence caused the Bush administration to declare a few empty artillery shells found in a bombed-out bunker to be the evidence necessary to launch an invasion. The backup excuse is that Saddam is a bad man. No doubt he's a brute. You know, he goes on through all this. But see, what Paul Craig Roberts fails to get is that the Bush administration, is that Karl Rove and George W. Bush did this war for a couple of reasons. George W. Bush, of course, wanted to show up his father. He's spent his whole entire life trying to show up his father, trying to prove that he's better than his dad, number one. Number two, Karl Rove saw this as something that would guarantee the election, the consolidation of Republican power in the House and Senate in the 2002 election, you know, getting ready for it. And in fact, it did. It created tremendous harm to those Democrats who tried to vote against the resolution to go to war, and that it would guarantee George W. Bush's Jr.'s election in 2004, that it would put him back into the White House. And that's what is so missing from the equation. People just don't get it, that this wasn't really even about oil. This wasn't about Israel. It wasn't about the Middle East. This was about domestic U.S. politics. This was about George W. Bush Jr. wanting to get himself reelected and Karl Rove wanting to make sure that not only did Bush get elected, but that the Republicans consolidated so much power in the House and Senate that there would be no investigations of all of the crimes of this administration. 10 minutes before the hour, I'm Tom Hartman.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
15, there's still time for you. Time to buy and time to lose.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you 5 minutes before the hour. The final point for the day, the final story for the day that I want to share with you. Just an extraordinary juxtaposition out of, I believe it's today's Wall Street Journal. And in fact, I'm pretty sure. Yeah, today's Wall Street Journal. Over on the left side of the page, an article, After Prison Boom, A Focus on Hurdles Faced by Ex-Cons, and they show a graph. The number of people on parole and probation under federal and state supervision. Before Ronald Reagan came into office, or when Ronald Reagan came into office in 1980, about 1 million, just slightly over 1 million people, nationwide, on parole or probation under state and federal supervision. Now, about 5 million. This is what 25, 30 years of conservative economic policies have brought us. We know, we just know as an absolute fact, and it just makes common sense, that when the economy is good, crime goes down. The best anti-crime program you can have is not cops on the street, it's jobs. Because most crimes, the vast majority of crimes, at least as small crimes, crimes of opportunity, crimes of economic need, things like that, they're not committed by people who made a decision early on in life to become career criminals. Now, people do make those decisions once they get into it, and particularly once they get incarcerated. But, you know, we know, you look at societies, as societies become more affluent, crime goes down, as long as the poverty is being lifted up as well. You have some, you know, European countries, very, very low crime rates, very poor countries, very high crime rates. This is not rocket science. During the time that the British were exporting Irish and sending them off, and British citizens for that matter, sending them off to Australia, why were they doing it? Typically, the crime, you know, as any Australian can tell you, typically the crime was stealing food or stealing the means to get food. And the British just shipped these folks off. At the on the right side of the page of today's Wall Street Journal, a story about just after 1:40 p.m. on the day after Thanksgiving, a luxury Gulfstream 4 jet takes off, goes to the Virgin Islands, and they go through this whole thing about how Barry Diller racked up all the, you know, over what? Over $832,000 worth of travel on the corporate jet. And how an executive, a CEO who has $43,000 worth of travel, will pay taxes on it as if it was income on $1,500. And we have 5 million people in prison. Our economy is out of balance. It is just totally out of balance. It needs help. You can help. See you tomorrow, same time, same place.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.